Welcome, everyone. This is the second edition of the Mises Academy class, Anatomy of the Fed. It was very popular the first time we offered it, and I hope you guys agree that it's an enlightening course. So tonight's lecture is on money and banking in a free market, and this is June 25th, 2012, just for purposes of posterity after the dollar collapses and people try to figure out what happened to the once great civilization known as the United States. So here is an outline of what we're going to be going over tonight. I realize there are some new people who may have never taken a Mises Academy class before, so let me just spend a few minutes giving people the backdrop here, the big context of what's going on. The way I do my classes, and I can't speak for other professors, but there's always going to be a PowerPoint sort of walking us through the live lectures. And we have recently integrated the use of writing utensils, so I can do things like write on the slides. And so that will help keep the discussion a little bit more dynamic, and also at certain points during the series when I would normally have to just put up a still image of a diagram, it'll be a lot easier for me to walk you guys through it and build it up step by step. So at some point you will have access to these PowerPoints also. A lot of times they're just sort of placeholders, like for just me just to scroll through and make sure I hit all the points. It's like an outline for myself basically to walk through the lecture, but at other points they are going to have information that will help you later on. And so, like I say, these things will be posted, so you'll be able to have those yourself if you want. Okay, so the first slide I always do when I start a new class is course description. And like I said, we do have a few people who have never taken a Mises Academy class, so this I'm going to go more slowly through this than I might in other classes. Okay, so first of all, there's the live lecture on Mondays. All right, so that's going to happen every week unless, I don't know, Ron Paul needs me to testify or something, but I will, and in that case, I would give you advance notice, but as far as my schedule looks, I think I should be able to do this every Monday on schedule without moving anything, and so that's what I'll plan on doing for you guys. Then there's going to be optional office hours on Saturday. All right, so for those of you who have been to college, that means you know what office hours are, but I know some people either are in high school right now or went into the real world and started serving society by being productive rather than wasting away another 4 years of college at keg parties. So what do I mean by office hours? It just means it's an hour-long session where I have the camera on and I field your guys' questions. So it's it'll give you an opportunity to ask me stuff. And it doesn't even have to just be tied to this particular material. But that there'll be a preference for that if somebody has a question about that week's material, I'll field those questions first, but you can ask me anything. So that's what those are for. Everything's going to be recorded. Should write that out. Okay. Everything is recorded. Okay, and I see someone asking about the time on the office hours. It's going to vary. All right, because for one thing, sometimes I have stuff that I have to do, like if my son's playing soccer or something, it depends what his game is going to be. But also, I'll try to put it at different times of day on Saturday in case some people have to always work at a certain time or they have a class or whatever. That way, there's a chance that people who want to see it live can sometimes see it. So I will always would give you at least, let's say, 48 hours notice in an email blast saying when this coming Saturday that 1 hour block will be, that if you want to come in. So what, it's just like the way you logged in to see this lecture tonight, that's what you would do on Saturday. And remember, it's optional, meaning that if you're taking, even if you're taking the class for credit and you're taking the quizzes and you're going to take the final exam and you want to get a grade out of this, that there's nothing I would ever say in those office hour sessions that I would test you on that isn't available in the assigned readings or in the normal Monday lectures. Okay, so that's what I mean when I say it's optional, that it can't possibly affect your grade as long as you do everything else you're supposed to do if you skipped every single one of those things. So it's truly optional in that sense. So everything is recorded. There's sometimes a lag because they have to, I don't quite understand it, but the video recording that WebEx does is not conducive. They don't do it like in an MP4, so somebody at the Mises Institute has to convert it somehow to a convenient format for you guys to be able to download and watch. And so there's sometimes a lag of 2 to 3 days between when the lecture happens and then when the video is posted. But it always will be posted. So if you miss something or you know you're going to be out of town or whatever, that's fine. You can still catch up. Okay, if you're taking the course for credit, let me be clear on how that's going to work. Okay, so first of all, you don't have to. And also, you don't need to tell me that you don't want to take it for credit, all right? So the way we would quickly figure out if you're just watching these lectures for fun and just your own edification, you don't want to be taking tests or anything, is just don't take the tests. So if we start racking up zeros for you, we're going to realize, oh, this person doesn't want to be graded for this course, and then it's not like you're going to get a 0% somewhere on your record. Oh, my gosh, we'll assume you didn't want to take it, okay? If you do want to take it, though, obviously don't miss anything. And here's how we're going to do it. Now, in the past, we have this problem, and I'm going to give me 2 minutes here to explain the situation because I always get a bunch of emails from people, and they think I'm a big jerk and everything, and I just want to explain why we do it this way. All right, with these classes, I usually get over 100 students, all right? And so given classes that size, for any given week, somebody is going to be sick, somebody's going to be out of town because they have a wedding to go to, blah, 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 you know what I mean? So we can't possibly change the schedule so that every single person who wants to can fit it into that time window. So the compromise we're doing this class is we're going to have a 2-week window. So for all of the quizzes and the final exam, there's a 2-week window to take them. Okay, so what do I mean? Sample, right now we're in week one. Okay, so there's going to be a quiz associated with the material we're covering in tonight's lecture. And every week for the main lecture that's on Monday, and then any of the reading that I assign to go with that material, which in the lecture and the reading will largely overlap. Okay, so there's going to be a multiple choice quiz that's got, what is it, 10 questions? Yeah, 10 questions. For weeks 1 through 8, so there'll be a total of 8 quizzes. And they're really simple. The weekly quizzes are very easy. They're just to keep you honest. All right, so in other words, if you watch my lecture and read the material and then take the quiz for that week, you should easily be able to get 8 of the questions and probably 9 or all 10, just if you, you know, there's no way you would get less than that as long as English is your native language or you're fluent in English. Okay, because that's how easy I'm making it. It's just to separate out people who literally didn't watch the lecture, didn't do the reading. Okay, the final exam covers all the material from weeks 1 through 8, and so technically the final will go active in the 9th week, as it were. So after that 8th week is up, and I'll be sending out email blasts to remind everybody every time I post one of these things. So it's not like right now you need to write down all this stuff and remember it 9 weeks from now. I'll remind you. I'm just telling you the big picture so there's no confusion. Okay, so but what do I mean about a two-week window? Okay, so right now it's week one. We're going to get, you know, I'm giving you the lecture today on Monday. Probably by Wednesday or Thursday, I will post quiz one. All right, so it will be the material pertaining to this week's one, week one's material. And then you will have, from the moment it becomes active, you will have 14 days in which to complete quiz one. Okay, so if you're, even if you're out of town or whatever, I mean, that's a huge window for you to do it. All right, but then after those 2 weeks are up, boom, quiz one is closed. And then you can no longer take quiz one. And the reason we do that is I want to be able to give feedback to people who took it. All right, so it has to close at some point so I can give everyone the answers so they can know why they got the score they got and so forth. So it doesn't work if some people take it right away and they want to know how they did. And then other people are saying, oh, gee, I have a wedding and I'm going to Europe and da-da-da-da-da, and so can I take quiz one during week six? That doesn't work because then I would have to make some people wait 6 weeks. You know what I'm saying? So it's this is the compromise we're doing with. So it's a little bit of a pain. People have to wait 2 weeks to see their answers, but I'm doing that because I know people travel a lot in the summer. Okay, so that's the compromise. And like I say, it's if you email me and say, hey, can you open? I just missed quiz two. Sorry, I forgot about it, or I broke my leg, or whatever. I was abducted by aliens. So come on, it doesn't, in the grand scheme, it's not going to hurt anybody. If you open up quiz two again, let me take it. It actually does hurt people. We actually had people complaining because this happened a few courses ago. Again, I'm spending some time on this because people always email me and can't believe how unreasonable I'm being in their minds. So let me just explain why. So people, a few courses ago, somebody emailed me and said, oh, my gosh, and he gave me this long story about how his girlfriend went crazy and attacked him with a knife or something. You guys think I'm kidding. I'm not. And can you extend the, you know, he'd missed the final, the window for the final by like a day. And he said, can you just open it up for another 36 hours because I didn't have time to study and I want to be able to do well in the course and get a good grade, da, da, da. So I thought, okay, fine. How's it hurting anybody else if I just extend it and let this guy take it? So I did that. And then, so other people had been asking me, I just made a general announcement because I wanted people to know, hey, the people of you who had been asking me, I relented, opened it up for this guy. So for those of you who were worried about time, now you've got an extra few days to take it. So I did all that, and then some kid's mom emailed me, and she was furious. And she said, my Jimmy is 16 years old or whatever. He's working two jobs, and he's studying at school, and da-da-da-da. And he stayed up till 3 a.m. studying for your exam and took it over the weekend because you told us that it was going to close on Sunday. And so he thought that was the rule, and now, you know, he did that. Had he known you were going to relent and extend it a few days, well, then he wouldn't have done that. He would have taken his time. He would have gotten a good night's sleep, and he would have studied some more. So his score right now is worse because, you know, he was following the rules, and then you changed the rules on us. Okay? So I really got an email like that, and I realized she's right. It's not fair if I'm telling the rules to one set of people, and then I change it. Okay? So that's why we're doing this, and that's why I just spent 3 minutes explaining the policy. So, again, 2 weeks for everything. Once the quiz is open, you have 2 weeks to take it. And notice there's going to be overlap, right? Because if I do weeks one material, open week one, that'll be open for 2 weeks. Then quiz two will open. So notice at any given time, there's going to be two quizzes that are open. And so that's probably going to screw people up too, but I guess we'll deal with that when it comes. Because what was happening is it seemed like 1 week of a window, which is what I used to do, wasn't enough. And I was getting all kinds of complaints from people saying that's unreasonable because I'm traveling or whatever. I had a really tough week at work. Come on. All right, so we're going to try this time with 2 weeks. All right, so that's how it works. And please do not email me if you miss the deadline and say, oh, come on, open it up again just for 10, 12 hours and I'll take it really fast. I'm going to say no. All right, so that's how that works. So let's move on. With any of this stuff, let me say one other thing too. I'll type it out. If you have any questions, send your emails to ta@mises.com. All right, so there are TAs, teaching assistants, for the Mises Academy classes, and that is the general email that they all have access to. So in the subject line, put something like, you know, Murphy Fed class, so they know what you're talking about. So any kind of technical, I'm having trouble logging in, hey, I'm trying to download lecture 3, what the heck, where is it, that kind of stuff, or I went to take the quiz and it didn't save my answers, what's the story? Any kind of issue like that, that it's a technical interface question with the logistics of you taking the course, send it to them. If you have more of a content question, like, you know, I really don't understand what Rothbard meant here when he said such and such in the reading that you assigned in week 4, can you elaborate? Any kind of question like that about the, you know, the contents of the course material, send those to me and let me give you my actual email address. So it's rpm@consultingbyrpm.com. All right, so RPM for Robert Patrick Murphy at consultingbyrpm.com. And then put in the subject line Academy Fed class or something like that, because I get tons of emails from people. And so if it's coming from somebody that's a student in a course, I want to know right away, so I give you guys priority. So don't put questions like that in the Moodle forum. Okay, because I don't, there's like a way, you know, the Moodle thing where you can see your Anatomy of the Fed course and has the syllabus and all that stuff, and that's where you'd be going to take the quizzes and the final if you're doing that. There's a way to like send me messages from within that environment, but don't use that because it's cumbersome and I won't see it for a while. All right, so again, if you want to send me a message, just use my standard email account that I just gave you. Okay, so did I mention the thing about the phone? I can't remember. Let me just say again. When you log into the lectures, it'll pop up and say something about how you call in with your telephone. Don't do that. That's you don't want to do that. Okay, let's start talking about the origin of money. Now this, it was, it's not invented. And what I mean here is, money isn't natural. Okay? And I mean that literally in the sense that it doesn't come from nature, right? So somebody might say, oh, money's the most natural thing in the world. Everybody's using money, but that's not the sense. I mean, it's not natural in the way that apples are natural or sunshine is natural or rainfall is a natural thing. Or if you want to say, hey, where do beaver dams come from? You could say, oh, well, beavers make them. That's a natural phenomenon. Okay. Money is clearly it's clearly man-made. However, so let me stop there. So a lot of people, a lot of thinkers, and even the man on the street, would say, okay, well, clearly then, if it's not a natural thing, if it's man-made, then it must be the result of deliberate human design. And this is a common way that people think that if something, and also it's very useful, right? So money is not just some accidental byproduct people think, because look, it's very useful to humans. So that's another attribute, right? Money is useful. So because of that, a lot of people conclude that therefore either some king or some group of elders or some wise legislature must have sat around one day and just decreed that, you know what, from now on, instead of just engaging in barter, we're going to use money. And but there's a problem with that. So specifically, and this I'll talk about in a second, but a lot of what I'm saying here even was first advance by Carl Menger. But in the next slide, I'll show you the specific book and so forth. Okay, so what are the problems with saying that money was just invented? Okay, so again, just to make sure we're all clear, what I'm doing right now is I'm saying, suppose a person gives the theory that, hey, I think money, because it's clearly a man-made thing, it's not natural, and because it's so useful, it serves humans, the fact that we have money, I'm thinking somebody must have intentionally designed it. And now I'm going to explain to you why that's a difficult theory to hold up. Okay, so for one thing, the idea of money sounds crazy if you didn't already understand how it worked. Okay, so if you think about it, I mean, just imagine you've got an originally a barter community, right? So people are trading things directly for other items that they want. So there's somebody who grows oranges, and he gets sick of eating oranges all day, and so then he sees somebody else lives a little bit further away, and that person has apples. And then he says, oh, hey, I'll trade you some of my oranges for some of your apples. And the apple guy thinks the same thing, but man, I'm getting sick of eating apples all the time. It'd be nice to have a different kind of fruit. Oh, yeah, that guy's got some oranges. Sure. And so they trade apples for oranges, and then they just vary their diet. Okay. Now imagine, and that's what everyone's doing. So somebody who has horses is trading horses for apples, and somebody who has timber on his land is cutting down the trees and selling the timber for apples and oranges and horses and so on. And maybe there's somebody who's raising pigs, and he sells the pigs for those things as well. Okay, so everyone's doing that. They're giving up stuff that they could use, but they have a surplus of, in order to get other things that they directly want to consume. That's directly serviceable to them. Okay, so that's perfectly straightforward. Everyone can immediately see the advantages of those trades, what economists call direct exchange. Okay? So now you say, all right, but there's actually limitations to that because they're not using money. And so if you think that money is useful, well, then you can see there's limitations to direct exchange. And in today's lecture, we don't have time to go into it too much, but just to give you an idea, there's lots of trades where it's sort of like it's not just a bilateral transaction. It's kind of thing where I have something that somebody else wants, but he doesn't have anything that I want. And then there's some third party that has something that the second guy needs or wants, but the second guy doesn't have what he wants, and so forth. And so if we could somehow all three of us like hand our thing over to the left, and we were like in a circle, then we would all be better off. But if we're limited to single shot bilateral trades, then there's no way to just have mutually advantageous trades. That, you know, make both parties better off within that one trade. And so if you think about what that means, it's saying there would be a way to rearrange the physical things in the world so that all the people are better off by their own subjective desires, and yet if just mechanically for reasons of the nature of the transactions, if we're limited to only being able to swap things in terms of two people can trade in one-shot transactions, and they're only going to do that if each, you know, if that swap makes both parties better off right at that moment. If you're limited to that, then you're missing out on all those other potential rearrangements of the goods that make everybody better off. Okay, so that's one way of thinking about what is it that money does. Or on the flip side, it's like saying, what are the drawbacks of direct exchange? Let me give you one other example to make it a little bit more intuitive. If you were limited to direct exchange, there couldn't be any specialization. or rather it would be extremely limited. All right, so you couldn't have, it would be hard to be a math teacher teaching fourth graders how to do the times tables and how to divide if you were limited to direct exchange, because what that would mean is you want to become a teacher and you want to just spend your whole day teaching fourth graders the times tables and whatever, and but if there's no money, then you have to find like the kids of parents who are butchers, because you got to be able to get your meat that way. And you also have to make sure some of your students have parents who make clothes, because that's where you're going to get your clothes from. And you got to make sure that some of your students have parents who are car mechanics, because, you know, if your car needs to be serviced, then you have to find a mechanic who's willing to do the labor on your car in exchange for teaching his or her kid how to do the times table, because that's the one thing that you're selling in trade, is the services of teaching kids how to do math. Okay, so you see what I'm saying? That it's, there's no way that would be practical for you to go full-time into just teaching people math if you had to directly get all the different things that you wanted to get from the marketplace, you know, indirect trades like that. There's just, the chances of that all working out right are too small. What would end up happening is you would grow your own food. You would make your own clothes, and then maybe occasionally you would teach somebody's kid some math, like for an hour or something, and then get tomatoes that day. But there's no way you could be a full-time math teacher. And then because of that, because most of your time would be spent growing food and making your own clothes, and you wouldn't even have a car because nobody would be in the business of making cars, you wouldn't be able to spend that much time studying math or studying different ways of educating. And so you wouldn't even be that good as a math teacher because you wouldn't have that much practice at it. Okay, so it's when you really start thinking through what would the world be like if you didn't have money, it's pretty limited. Okay, so I'm just explaining there why money is so useful. But having said all that, even though we now know, having grown up in a world that uses money, and it's so obvious to us all the many advantages because we can see what a world with money looks like, I'm saying step back. Imagine you grew up in a world of just pure barter, in more particular where people just trade things that they're going to directly use. So in that kind of world, if somebody came along and started talking about money, they would sound like a nut job. They would sound crazy. So, again, go back to what I was talking about 10 minutes ago. You got a world where somebody has oranges, and he eats a lot of his own oranges, but he gets sick of it, and so then he walks around, and if he sees a guy with extra sheep, he says, hey, I'll give you 1,000 oranges for one of your sheep, and maybe the sheep farmer says, oh, okay, and things like that, and people just make these one-off, mutually advantageous trades. Now, the king of these people wakes up one day, and he says, whoa, you guys aren't going to believe this. I have a phenomenal idea. Instead of you doing these one-shot trades where you're giving up something that you might want to eat yourself or use yourself, but you have so much of it, those last few units really aren't that important to you, and then you get other things that you really like from other people who are in the same boat, instead of you guys doing that, how about you give up the valuable things that you have in exchange for something that's completely useless to you. Like, for example, and he picks up a shell off the ground. He says, like, for these shells. Okay, so from now on, you guys who have oranges, and you've got so many oranges, you're sick of them, and you're willing to go sell off some oranges to try to buy other things, right now you're in the habit of walking around and seeing what you actually want, and then you try to make a trade with that person. And sometimes the person doesn't want oranges, and you're out of luck. But what I'm telling you, me being this king with this phenomenal idea, is I want you to give up your oranges for these shells that are completely useless to you. How does that strike you? And the guy with the orange is going to say, what, are you crazy? Why would I do that? And he's going to say, oh, no, you're not seeing the logic, man. It's not just you. Everybody is going to do the same thing. So the guy who gives up, you know, right now the guy selling apples, and he only gives up his apples right now if somebody offers him something that he directly desires. If he follows my idea too, then he'll give up the apples for the shells. So you, Mr. Orange grower, don't worry about you getting ripped off by giving up your oranges for these shells, because you can then use the shells to go get the apples or the horses or the sheep or whatever it is you want to buy. And because, like I say, everyone's going to be doing this. So you're right. If I just made you give up your oranges for these shells and nobody else did it, then that would be terrible for you. But that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying everybody, all at the same time, is going to stop engaging in direct exchange, and we're all going to simultaneously flip over and start using these shells. So everybody now, whenever he enters a transaction, one half of the transaction is going to involve somebody getting these shells. And if you just think about it, you can still make the same ultimate trades just going through these shells. So if you right now we're going to sell oranges in order to get apples, you can still do that. All I'm saying is first sell your oranges for these shells, then use your shells to acquire the apples, because the apple guy, whenever he wants to get rid of apples, I'm saying now he's going to take shells in exchange. Okay, what do you guys think of that? And people would assassinate the king, right? I mean, that would sound like it would sound like at best it would mimic what they're already doing, and at worst somebody would get caught holding the old maid. For foreigners who don't know that, it's a card game where there's a particular card that you lose the game if you get stuck with it. Okay, and so what I'm saying here is these shells seem like nobody wants them, and it's like the king's trying to trick people into, well, you take the shell because don't worry, you'll be able to trick somebody else too, and you'll be able to get rid of the shell for something that's actually valuable. All right, so the way I just described that, the king sounds insane, doesn't he? And yet I think you can see that's pretty much what a fiat money economy looks like. Now, I know, obviously, I'm sure most of you taking this class agree with me that fiat money is not as good as commodity money. But the point is, fiat money is better than having no money. So if you had an economy that was just direct barter and somehow everybody could go to using fiat money the next day, they would be fantastically richer, just because money is so incredibly good for promoting the division of labor and economic calculation and so on, especially if the fiat money didn't have too high a degree of inflation. Okay, so what I'm saying is that king actually would have had a great idea, but he would sound nuts if he said that, and it would be understandable that nobody would listen to him. Okay, he probably wouldn't even come up with the idea anyway. I mean, you would have to be a complete genius to just grow up in a barter world and then imagine, wait a minute, what if everybody used a single commodity that was on one half of every or one side of every transaction? Okay? So the point is, probably no one would even think of it, but even if somebody did, it would sound crazy. All right, so again, just to make sure you're not getting lost here, what I'm trying to go over here is to show you that when you were trying to explain how did money emerge historically, it's not a very convincing theory to say, well, somebody just must have invented it, because that it's implausible. Let me give you another example of what the problem is. Even if the king enforced it, he would have to set all prices too. Okay, so what do I mean by this? So let's just continue with that goofy story I was telling. So you had people that were just engaged in direct barter in the beginning. And then the king wakes up and he has this brilliant idea, tells everyone, I want you to use these shells instead of directly trading oranges for apples. You know, sell your oranges for the shell first, then use the shells to go buy the oranges, or apples, whatever I said. And the people are like, no, that's crazy. But he says, no, you guys don't see how right I am, and I hate to do this, but you know what? And he calls up his soldiers and says, if you catch anybody engaging in a barter trade, then kill them. All right? Because I'm serious. I want everybody to start trading for these shells first. And any purchase has to involve the use of these shells. I don't want to see anybody doing barter anymore. And if you get caught, you're dead. All right, so if the king is willing to enforce it and the soldiers really go out and hunt down people, and you could say, all right, would that be enough to get everyone to now use these shells as money? Well, look at the problem. It's not enough just to say, okay, we're going to use these shells as money now. In other words, you might think that before, with our discussion, the stumbling block was that everybody would be afraid to sort of dip his toe in the water and start using it. But you might think, under the threat of the sword, if everyone agrees at the same time, okay, fine, we'll use these shells as money, that would be the end of the the end of the problem. You might think, okay, that could do the trick. But no, it would, because still, imagine you're the person with the oranges, and you wanted to go get a sheep. And so before, under direct exchange or barter, you would go up to the guy who owned all the sheep, and you'd say, hey, I'll give you 1,000 oranges for one of your sheep. And he says, okay. So now the king comes along and says, no, can't do that. I want you to use these shells, or else you get killed. So you fear for your life, and you don't want to take chances. So you say, okay, fine. I will sell my oranges first for these shells, and then just go take the shells down to the guy with the sheep, and then I'll use the shells to buy the sheep. So you say, okay, well, so okay, oranges for sale, and then so somebody comes up and says, okay, here, I got 5 shells. How many oranges do I get for that? And now you, the orange dealer, you have no idea, right? Because you don't know what the purchasing power of those shells are. So you might try to think and say, well, let me charge a price such that if I sell 1,000 oranges, I get enough shells so that with those shells, I can go get one sheep so that I'm basically making the same trade as I was before. Now I'm just going through the shells. And it's just that extra hassle, that extra step. But you can't do that, because right now, you know, we've just made the switch. And so you don't know how much the sheep guy is going to charge. You don't know how many shells it takes to buy one sheep. And you might say, well, why don't you just wait and see what he's charging? But look at what I'm saying here. You, the orange guy, when you're trying to figure out how many shells should I ask for, let's say, 100 oranges, you can't make your move, you can't announce your price until you see what the sheep guy says. But he's in the same position. The sheep guy might be thinking, well, gee, before, if I sold one sheep, I could get 1,000 oranges. So before I announce my price, I want to see how many shells does it take to get 1,000 oranges, and that's what I'm going to charge for one of my sheep. You see how that works? And that's the situation that every seller finds himself in. So what I'm getting at here is, it's not enough to say that a particular commodity or a particular thing, if the shell hadn't been a commodity before, it's not enough just to designate some physical thing and say, oh, that's the unit of money in this world or this society. That alone doesn't give people enough information to switch over from a barter economy to a monetary economy, because they need to know beyond that what the purchasing power of that thing is in order to be able to make transactions. So in other words, when you're selling your valuable goods and services in exchange for the money commodity, it's not enough for you to know that, oh, that thing is the money. You also need to know, have a vague idea at least, of how many units of this money commodity do other people ask when selling the kind of things I want to buy with it. So one way of seeing this is, suppose you were you went into one of those cryogenic stasis chambers, and you were put to sleep for 50 years, and then they woke you, they revived you in 50 years, and you came out, and you, you know, you're amazed by all the technology, and there's hover cars, and there's all kinds of, you know, there's skyscrapers that are so high up in the atmosphere that they have to use special windows and so forth to keep the pressure up there and so forth, and then you somehow end up at a factory, and they're saying, hey, okay, do you want to, labor's incredibly productive now, you're going to use these machines, and you can produce 100 cars in an hour of your labor, and you're like, wow, that's great, and the owner of the plant says to you, so I'm willing to hire you, and I'm going to pay you $300 an hour. Does that sound like a good deal? And you wouldn't know, right? Because you would realize, wait a minute, 50 years have passed. I have no idea what things cost. Sure, $300 an hour would have been great 50 years ago when I first went to sleep. But before I answer this guy's question, I need to go to the grocery store. I want to go see how much does a gallon of milk cost. I want to go to the, if they use gasoline still, I want to go to the gas station and see how much is a gallon of gas. I want to go to an apartment complex and see for a nice apartment how much do I have to pay per month. You know what I'm saying? So you would have no idea how much to ask for your hour of labor unless you went and saw what the purchasing power of the dollar was or the euro or whatever, depending on where you live. Okay, so it may look like it may seem like I just presented this impossible situation. It looks like, okay, we know money didn't just come about through nature. It's not like a biological thing. We know that humans somehow invented it. And so we also think that at one point humans didn't use money. And then at some point, clearly they were using it because right now everybody uses money. And so there had to have been a point at which money started being used, and yet it seems like I just showed it's very dubious that somebody could have invented it. And so we're in this pickle. And man, how are we going to get around this? It almost seems like we have to come up with a story, but didn't I kind of just show that any kind of story isn't going to work? And no, we didn't actually. And so let me give you Menger's theory. So this is Carl Menger. There he is. All right, so this is Carl Menger. And he is the founder of the Austrian School of Economics. And so his book, which came out in 1871, obviously he wrote it in German. It was called the Grundsatz. I see someone in the notes saying, Murphy says, Euro to exist 50 years from today. Not necessarily. In my thought experiment, I could have been talking to someone who went to sleep in 1970. Okay, so Menger came out with his book in 1871, and in this book, he did all kinds of stuff. For example, he was one of the three pioneers of the subjectivist, or what is often called the marginal revolution. All right, so Menger did all kinds of stuff in this book, but as Austrian economists, we will point to that and say that is the founding of what we now call the Austrian school. And the thing that's particularly neat about that book is obviously no book ever is in a vacuum. Every writer in history relies to some extent on ideas and thinkers that came before. But I think it was Schumpeter that said Menger was nobody's pupil. All right, when Schumpeter was talking about the history of economic thought. So, for example, Eugen von Bombawerk was Menger's pupil, and Ludwig von Mises could be said to have been a pupil or a disciple or a student of Menger and Bombawerk. All right. Not necessarily meaning that Mises was literally in the classroom his whole life learning from their lectures, but that Mises read Menger's Grundsatz and said, oh my gosh, this is how we should think about economics. All right. Whereas Menger kind of just did this on his own. And so, look, we don't have time to go through all the cool things he did in this book, but one of the most important things that he did was he gave the modern subjective value theory of price formation and threw out the old classical labor theory or cost theory of value. Okay, and that's why he's considered one of the three pioneers now in what's been called the marginal revolution. All right, that's not what we're talking about. Oh, the other two pioneers, somebody's asking, were William Stanley Jevons. Oops, I spelled that wrong. William Stanley Jevons and Leon Walras. Okay, I'm not going to quiz you on those guys' names, but somebody asked me in the thing. And the reason that they all came out with fairly independent works in the early 1870s explaining market prices using a marginal subjectivist approach, as opposed to saying, oh, the reason a stagecoach trades for 1,000 apples is that it takes the same amount of labor time to produce 1,000 apples as it does to produce a stagecoach. Okay, so that would be a labor theory or a cost theory of value, where you're explaining market prices by reference to how much labor went into those things. And that was kind of how the classical economists reasoned, at least in the long run. And so Menger and the other two came up with a different approach. And they first and foremost explained market prices by reference to the buyer's subjective marginal evaluation of the usefulness of the good. And then once you had that framework down, you could step back and sort of give an equilibrium argument that involves cost of production and so on, but the causality ran the opposite way. Okay, but that's not so much what concerns us tonight. What concerns us tonight is that Menger's theory of the origin of money. Okay, so let me just clear off the slide here. Okay, so first of all, Menger notes that even in barter, different goods have different degrees of what he called, and of course we're translating from the German, salability, what we might call liquidity, I think is probably the best modern term. And the, what you might call marketability, maybe that helps you. So here, notice these terms do not mean that something has market value. Okay, so something could be very valuable in terms of what you can get for it in the marketplace, but it wouldn't be liquid. And so let me make sure you understand that distinction. For example, a house or a sports car are very valuable so long as they're in good condition, right? They're worth a lot in terms of market value, but they're not very liquid. In fact, they're very illiquid. All right. So, for example, somebody's house might be worth $300,000. When you say worth, what you mean is if you were to sell it and you gave yourself enough time to find the right buyer, you could get $300,000 for it. All right. But it might take you 6 months to get that money, to turn the house into actual dollars in your bank account, might take you 6 months. So that's the sense in which you'd say the house is valuable, because $300,000 is a lot of money to most people, but you'd say it's not very liquid. On the other hand, a sports car, let's say that has a, people would say, oh, it's worth $50,000. Well, that's pretty valuable too. It's not as valuable as the house, but it's more liquid. If you really needed cash quickly, you would probably be able to turn your sports car into cash more quickly than you'd be able to turn a house into cash. And then something like bonds issued by a major corporation, those are very liquid. So maybe you could have $10,000 worth of corporate bonds. So they're still valuable, but they're not as valuable as the sports car, and they're not as valuable as the house, but they're much more liquid, because it wouldn't take you very long to turn those bonds into the appropriate amount of cash. Now, there's actually different ways of seeing it. If I really needed to sell my sports car next week, I could lower the asking price, right? So maybe what I mean is to say, when I say it's worth $50,000, maybe what I mean is that if I spent a good month putting ads in the paper and various internet sites and did all kinds of stuff to find the right buyer, I could get $50,000 for it. But if I asked only $20,000, maybe I could sell it within a week. And maybe I'd have to let somebody come inspect it, because they would be thinking, what's wrong with it? Why are you selling it for $20,000? Because it looks to be like a much more valuable car. So if I could convince the person that nothing was wrong with it, I could probably sell it in a week for $20,000. All right, so there's that issue there. Okay, but so again, Menger is saying that even though in those examples I was assuming there was such a thing as money, I was quoting everything's market price in terms of dollars, that principle still would have existed even before money did. So the example I like to use is, let's say you're going into town with a telescope. And it's a very valuable telescope, right? It's not some cheap little thing that's made out of plastic or something. I mean, it is an intricate instrument that Galileo or somebody made, right? So at the time you're doing this, this is like the most sophisticated telescope on planet Earth. Okay, so it's very valuable if we mean you have a year to find the right buyer for it. If you have a year to search and to advertise for it, then you could ultimately obtain a lot of other goods and services for this telescope. But it's very illiquid. There's not a big market for this intricate telescope. Not many people even care about it. They might say, oh yeah, that's nice, but especially if we're thinking in the distant past, not many people are going to be able to use that thing. All right, so it's very illiquid, even though it might be valuable in a certain way of defining that term. Okay, so let's say you're going into town and you've got this telescope, and what you really want to do is get a bunch of apples. So the issue is there going to be what's called a double coincidence of wants? All right, that's a phrase that economists use a lot when talking about money. Oops. Double coincidence of wants. And there probably won't be, or it's very unlikely that there will be. Okay, so what the point is, there's not many people out there who appreciate this telescope and understand how important it is or how valuable it is. And then of the people who do understand that, what are the chances that they also have a bunch of apples that they're willing to give up? on that day when you're trying to make the trade. You see? So that's the difficulty. Because remember, we're in a world right now of barter, of direct exchange. Okay, so what Menger pointed out is there's two things you could do. If you've got this telescope or you've just got something that's very illiquid, you could just spend all your time exploring the Earth looking for the right buyer. But there's another option at your disposal. What you could do is you could make an exchange with somebody who doesn't have the thing that you're actually trying to acquire, but has something that is at least more liquid than the thing you're giving up. So the point is, you're the guy with the telescope. Maybe you're going to find somebody who has, what did I say, oranges? Or no, I said you're trying to get apples. So you don't find somebody that has apples, but you find somebody who has sheep. And it just so happened that the guy with a bunch of sheep went to town that day saying, I would really like to get an intricate, sophisticated telescope. I wonder if anyone will have that for me. Boy, I would give up a bunch of sheep to get that telescope. So the point is, you're the guy with the telescope, and you realize that, you know, this guy is giving me a good offer. It's true, I personally don't need sheep, but I can see price ratios in the marketplace, and I recognize the amount of sheep that he's offering to me, I could go trade those to somebody else and get a lot of apples for him. And so he would make that trade, even though he doesn't want the sheep. He has no use for sheep. Okay, and then he takes the sheep, and then he goes and trades them for the apples. Okay, so notice what happened there. The guy who had sheep found that because the sheep were more marketable than the telescope, then that meant the marketability of the sheep actually got magnified, right? Because originally, some people in the community wanted sheep, but not everyone did. But because some of those people who didn't actually want sheep originally for their own sake recognized that sheep were more marketable than the stuff they started out with, they were willing to accept the sheep. And so the marketability of the sheep got enhanced because of its initial superiority. So in other words, the things that just start out just because of the distribution of preferences in the community, so when we're starting out in initially pure direct exchange where everyone just trades things for stuff they directly want to use themselves, even in that initial setup, some goods are going to have a much broader market than others. But the point is now when people start realizing the limitations of direct exchange, they start engaging in indirect exchange. They start taking things with the only intention of trading them away. And which things will they be willing to do that with? Well, only things that have a bigger market than what they're giving up. Otherwise, that would be stupid. And so the things that start out that have a relatively big market compared to most other stuff, they, in fact, get more people to accept them once people start doing indirect exchange. And so it enhances their own marketability, and it sets up a snowball effect. So ultimately, one or a few commodities end up being accepted by everybody. So if it turned out in this hypothetical community that everybody accepted sheep for whatever they were selling because they knew, oh, once I turn my goods into having sheep, I'm set. Because whatever it is that I want to get, when I find that person, there's no doubt he's going to be willing to accept sheep because everybody accepts sheep when they're trying to sell something. Well, then that's what money is. Okay, so money is a medium of exchange accepted by all. All right, so I kind of went fast at the tail end of that story there, but I took a while explaining, I hope you got that part, why the guy with the very illiquid thing would trade it for something that was more liquid, but not what he ultimately wanted. And that was pretty straightforward. That was the hard part of the story. If you get that, the rest of it's pretty quick because you realize other people start doing that, And they might do it not just with sheep, but other people might do it with oranges or whatever. And so then some things see their marketability enhanced. And then that process just continues over time, and people more and more observe, oh, you know what? Lots of people are willing to accept sheep. And so I start selling more or oranges or whatever. And then if it ever just gets to the point where there's one commodity, or it could be two or three, it's just about anybody is willing to accept when they're getting rid of their goods, then that thing is money. That's what money is. Okay? So, notice what Menger has done there. He has gone step by step and explained how we could start out in pure direct exchange and then end up in a monetary economy. And at no point in the explanation did anybody have to be a genius. Did anybody have to be able to step back and look at the whole thing and say, oh, you guys realize what we're doing here? We're inventing money. Nobody even needs to realize that. In fact, they probably wouldn't even realize it until it had already happened and they had been doing it for a long time. And then someone might step back and say, you know, isn't that kind of weird that we all use this one commodity? That's weird. Okay, but it would happen spontaneously. And that is an example of what Hayek calls a spontaneous order, if you've heard that expression. And this is the origin of money is a classic example of things that are the result of human action, but not of human design. Okay, so again, this is a neat little example of reasoning, of social theorizing, where Menger is trying to explain, and it's sort of armchair logic, and some people have criticized it on that ground, but whether you like it or don't, it's an interesting example of saying this is a way we can sort of explain step by step how people could have, if you want to say, developed the use of money without anyone or any group consciously having invented it, even though there's a sense in which people invented money. If what you mean by invent is they did things that brought it into existence, but nobody was intending to create money per se. Each person was just doing something that step by step was advantageous at the time, given the alternatives, and then when all those actions came together, the result was, boom, after a while, people are using a single medium of exchange. And that's what money is. Okay, let's keep going here. The value of money. How can we explain the value of money? And what I mean by value is it's market value. Why is it the money commodity has a certain purchasing power? Why is it that you have units of money that you are able to go out in the marketplace and trade them and obtain other valuable goods and services? So really the issue is, why do people who have things that are valuable directly, like sheep and oranges and apples, where, you know, those convey direct utility to the holder, why is it that they would be willing to give up something for money? Because on the face of it, that just seems weird. So remember, we talked about the problem with the shell and how it seems kind of weird. But it's also true even if we're talking about a commodity money. Okay, so under Menger's, I should probably take a minute to explain this part of it. Within Menger's framework, we can totally understand how gold and silver came to be the dominant forms of money once the market economy had swept the world. All right, so I've already given you with Menger's story the basic framework for how regular commodities could have emerged as money. And now let me tell you why gold and silver were particularly good candidates for that. So initially it could have been things like sheep, and in fact historically cattle were money. And you also had things like tobacco, especially in POW camps. You'd have cigarettes, or really it was the tobacco that was money. And you would have all kinds of different things in different, I think salt maybe in some cultures. Okay, so different places historically had different things that served as money. But once, like as I say, the market economy sort of embraced most of the whole world, it was gold and silver that swept the tide and that were embraced by everybody's money and sort of displaced everything else. So why is that? Well, the reason is that if you're going to be getting rid of relatively illiquid goods in exchange for liquid goods, things that you know can be traded easily and have a wide market, that's not the only criterion. You're also going to consider how useful is this thing for me to be holding instead of whatever I first came to market with. So let's go back to that story I was telling you. You come to market with this big telescope, and you see, oh, there's a guy who's offering sheep for it. You know, that's a pretty good offer he's making to me. With the amount of sheep he's willing to sell me for this telescope, I know vaguely from past experience how many apples I can get for one sheep. And so, yeah, doing the math, the amount of sheep he's willing to give me for this telescope, knowing the sheep-apple ratio, I can implicitly figure out really how many apples I'm getting for my telescope. And that's a pretty good deal he's making for me. But it's kind of a pain to have to transport the sheep. You know, what if the apple guy is 10 miles away from the sheep guy? You know, the only consideration is not just the implicit price ratio and the fact that the thing I'm getting I know is more liquid than what I'm giving up. There's other considerations. So if you got the guy here offering me sheep and then someone over here is offering me gold and he's saying, well, no, I'll give you whatever, 3 ounces of gold for that telescope, even if that's not quite as good a deal in terms of the implicit price ratios, in other words, if I know, I know with gold I could also get a bunch of apples, and actually I would get 9 fewer apples accepting this gold seller's offer as opposed to the sheep guy, but how much easier is it for me to carry 3 ounces of gold than however many sheep this guy's going to give me? Like, what if I don't like sheep? You know, they're going to make me smell, or they're going to, you know, they have issues. They go to the bathroom, so the gold isn't going to go to the bathroom on me. I don't have to worry if I have to camp overnight on the way to the apple guy. It's a lot easier for me to hide the 3 ounces of gold and protect them than it is if I'm moving a bunch of sheep. You know, I can't go to sleep because they're either going to go away or someone's going to come and steal them. Okay, you see what I'm saying? So there's practical logistical difficulties, and it's not purely a matter of the price ratios. And so you can see how, you know, what are the properties of gold and silver that make them wonderful media of exchange? Well, they're very durable, whereas things like oranges are going to go bad if you don't get rid of them pretty soon. They're divisible. Okay, so that's why, like, diamonds aren't a good money. If you think about it, like, diamonds, you might think should be money just like gold and silver because, hey, they're pretty to look at and they're fairly scarce and so on. But the problem with diamonds is that if you have more diamond than you need for a given transaction, you can't just cut the diamond in half. Whereas if you have an ounce of gold, it's fine to cut it in half and just pay a half an ounce of gold. Whereas you cut the diamond, that screws it. First of all, it's difficult to cut a diamond, and also you're going to screw it up. Like, that's, you wouldn't want to do that just for purposes of making change. Related to that is the issue that gold and silver are fairly homogeneous among different units. And so basically an ounce of gold is an ounce of gold, whereas an ounce of diamonds is not the same as another ounce of diamonds. If you have one giant diamond that weighs 1 ounce, that has a higher market value than 100 diamonds that each are only 1/100th of an ounce. Okay, so, and the reason is you can't take the little diamonds and put them and form one big diamond, whereas if you have a half an ounce of gold here and a half an ounce of gold there, you can just melt it down and make one big ounce of gold. So there's no issue there. What other properties? Also, gold and silver have convenient market values for their weight, for their physical weight, to be convenient as forms of money. So gold is useful for bigger purchases, and then the silver is good for smaller purchases. And whereas copper or bronze have many properties in terms of being metals that make them similar to gold and silver, but they're not as good as money because they're too plentiful. That in order for you to make purchases, you would need too much bronze or copper to get the job done as compared to gold and silver. On the other hand, something like platinum or like uranium, or, well, uranium also has other problems too, right? But you see what I'm saying? There's metals that are scarcer than gold and silver that don't work because they're too scarce. That for most purchases, it would just be, the amount involved would be so little, it would just be impractical. And so that's, so I'm listing reasons why gold and silver make very excellent monies, because if you just list out all the criteria for the people in the situation I describe, when they're going to market and they want to get rid of their illiquid goods and accept liquid goods in exchange, things that they're going to hang on to while they scope out and look for the stuff they ultimately want to buy, if you listed out all the criteria for what would make a good useful to serve as a medium of exchange, I think you'll find that gold and silver are at the top of the list on every criteria, whereas the other things you could think of might be good or as good or even better than gold and silver on a few criteria, but they would get blown out of the water on some other ones. And so the gold and silver really don't have any strikes against them, and they're pretty good or awesome on the other criteria. And there's no other commodities like that, at least not historically. Okay, so that's why gold and silver tended to emerge as the market's monies in terms of commodity money. Okay, so now having said all that, how do we explain the value of money? Why would somebody, but my point is, still, how do we explain the purchasing power? So yeah, gold and silver are valuable, but what, you know, why if I'm giving up something, would I give up an hour of my labor for 1 ounce of silver? Why not 100 ounces of silver? Why not 2 ounces? See, so what determines the purchasing power? And it's true, part of it involves the fact that they used to be useful commodities by themselves, but once they start getting accepted as money, their purchasing power goes up, right? Their value in the marketplace is higher because now people are accepting them in trade, not just to use for industrial purposes or not just to make jewelry, but now they're being accepted as their, in their capacity as money. And so if we just focus on that, we're actually back to the problem with the shells. And it's like, how do we explain the monetary value of the money commodity? So how do we explain the value of the purchasing power of gold qua money? Qua is just a fancy word meaning as. Okay, and that's the issue. Okay, so pitfalls. I'm going a little bit over time here, so let me speed up. The problem is, it seemed circular to use the subjective value approach on money. All right, so like I said, Menger and then Bobrick and Wieser and so forth had elaborated the marginalist subjectivist explanation for price formation when it came to conventional goods and services. So Menger or Bumbauer really had perfected the explanation. And Danny Sanchez actually has a good article on that. Danny, if you're still listening, can you post in the thing about the horse market with Bumbauer? Danny had a good Mises.org article walking through Bumbauer's explanation a while back, if you're interested in seeing that. So Bumbauer, by that point, and the evolution of what we would now call Austrian economics, then this would have been the late 1800s, they had already worked out how you could explain the relative market values of real goods and services, right? So why does a pound of apples trade for 2 pounds of oranges? Or why does one stagecoach trade for 1,000 pounds of apples and so on? They could explain that using marginal subjective value theory. But what they had trouble doing was explaining why is it that one stagecoach trades for 2 ounces of gold. They had trouble with that. And the reason is that, right, Danny, that is the one I meant. So it's called the mystery of the marginal pairs. So if you just Google that and say Daniel Sanchez, it's a Mises.org article. If you want to see what I'm talking about when I say Bombavrik explained using marginal value theory, how you can explain market prices, but not in terms of money. Okay, so again, what's the problem here? It seemed problematic. It seemed like, oh yeah, this is great. This new subjectivist revolution, the stuff these Austrian economists are pioneers in, it's great for explaining barter trades. But it seemed like you couldn't explain money, and here's why. Because it looked like what you were saying, because here's how it would go. You'd say, hey, why is it that if I have a stagecoach, I'm willing to trade it for 3 ounces of gold? And so if you're going to answer it as a marginal subjective value theorist, you'd say, oh, well, because the guy giving up the stagecoach got more utility from the 3 ounces of gold than he got from the stagecoach, and the buyer got more utility from the stagecoach than he got from the 3 ounces of gold. So that's why it was a voluntary trade. You say, okay, that's fine as far as it goes, but wait a minute. Why did the guy who gives up the 3 ounces of gold, gives up the stagecoach for the 3 ounces of gold, why on his personal scale of preferences does he value the gold more than the stagecoach? And so here's where now the answer gets apparently circular, as you say, oh, because he's looked around and he's seen in the marketplace that 3 ounces of gold can buy a lot of different stuff. He knows it has purchasing power. And so that's why he values it, because he ultimately values the things he can acquire with it. He can look one step ahead. So that's why. So you see how that looks like it's circular? Because the critic can say, whoa, that's what we're trying to explain. We're trying to explain why is it that gold can be traded for other stuff in the market. Why does it have such a high purchasing power as money? And you basically just told me because it's money. You basically said people value money because money is valuable. And yeah, that's true, but come on, you're just moving in a circle, right? So that was the issue and why people thought that you couldn't use the new Mengerian approach to explain the purchasing power of money. So Mises comes along, and he does explain it. And this is what's been referred to as his famous regression theorem. Now, I'm running out of time. I only got about 10 minutes left in tonight's lecture, so I'm not going to go through this step by step here, because I walk you through it step by step in the article that's assigned for week one. The origin of money and its value or something like that. So it's a Mises.org article, so I wrote it out. I went through it carefully. Let me just give you the quick synopsis right now. So Mises said, you're not arguing in a circle. What happens is today somebody sells his stagecoach for 3 ounces of gold, and why does he do that? Because he anticipates that tomorrow he's going to be able to take those 3 ounces of gold and go buy a bunch of apples with it. All right, so far I'm not arguing in a circle. And then you say, well, how does he get those expectations? You say, oh, because yesterday he saw through observation that 3 ounces of gold could fetch a large number of apples in the marketplace. And so that leads him today to make the forecast that tomorrow the purchasing power will be fairly similar, and that's how he gets it. And so Mises is saying, obviously I'm paraphrasing, Mises didn't say it quite this way, but I'm just trying to make it intuitive for you guys. Mises is saying, look, I'm not arguing in a circle. I'm saying today's purchasing power of gold is based on expectations of its purchasing power tomorrow, which themselves are derived from my observation of its purchasing power yesterday. So I haven't said, oh, I'm explaining the purchasing power of gold by reference to the purchasing power of gold. He's just saying, no, you got to put the time element in. Really what I'm doing is explaining gold's purchasing power today ultimately by reference to its purchasing power yesterday. So that's not moving in a circle. So now the critic comes back and says, oh, okay, fine. You're not arguing in a circle, but you've got an infinite regress. You're explaining purchasing power today by reference to its purchasing power yesterday. But then if we pushed it back one step, it's okay, why did gold, you know, how come 3 ounces of gold could buy so many apples yesterday? Then you, Mises, would say, oh, it's because people observed what it could do the day before yesterday, wouldn't you? So see, you're just, you know, you're not solving the problem. You just keep pushing it back one day. So come on, that's a dead end. And Mises says, no, it's not. Because, yeah, we can trace it back day by day by day, but it's not an infinite regress. There is a logical stopping point. We go back, and we stop at the point at which gold was a regular commodity and was not a medium of exchange. All right, so there's nothing wrong philosophically with that argument. It's not circular. I'm explaining the purchasing power of money today by reference to its purchasing power yesterday, and it's not an infinite regress. It's a finite regress. At some point, it stops, and at that point, when the commodity in question was just a regular commodity in a barter world or a direct exchange world, I can explain its purchasing power, its market value, just by reference to Menger's standard theory, right? Because it wasn't money at that point. All right, so that's what Mises did. So, yeah, I mean, that's brilliant. If he had just done that, he would probably be revered by Austrian economists today as, wow, that was great. And, of course, Mises went on to do all kinds of other stuff. Okay, in the remaining 6 minutes, let me say this. Normally, during these lectures, I will leave time at the end for Q&A, but today, since I took 15 minutes or whatever going over the basics of the class and how the course works, I kind of ran out of time, right? So normally going forward, I will leave in a margin for your guys' Q&A, you know, for these live Monday sessions, but today is an exception to that. Okay, loan. So there's different kinds of, there's two, whoops, need to do that. There's two main types of banking, and this is the way that Rothbard likes to break things out. Okay, so the first kind is called loan banking, and what are could be called savings, what we can think of as savings accounts. All right, so here the bank acts as a credit intermediary. So you've got the savers over here, and you've got the borrowers over here. And so what happens is the savers effectively make a loan to the bank, and then the bank makes a loan to the borrowers. So what's important here to realize is the savers are relinquishing that money. It's not their money anymore during the length of the loan. So maybe what they do, for example, is maybe they buy a CD, a certificate of deposit. Or maybe they put their money in what's called a savings account, and the rules of the account say you have to keep this money in here for at least 6 months before you can take it out, something like that. All right, and then so the money itself is legitimately legally transferred and is now the property of the bank, And instead what the family gets is a claim, a promise, an IOU saying in the future the bank will give you so much money. But right now that's not your money anymore, family. And then the bank in turn makes a loan to the borrowers, which might be some business that wants to build a new factory. Okay, so the term credit intermediary means the bank is in between the ultimate savers or lenders and the ultimate borrowers. And the bank's function here, why is it economically useful? Well, there's two things. One is that it pools the risks, right? So the individual families, if they just individually gave money directly to a home buyer, for example, and then that guy lost his job and could no longer make his mortgage payments, if there were just like 20 families that were directly linked up to that one home buyer, then their entire savings would be lost. So instead of that, what happens is you've got thousands of families who all lend their money to the one bank, and then the bank makes mortgage loans to hundreds of borrowers who then go out and buy their homes and make mortgage payments. So the few that default and can't pay their mortgages, that loss effectively gets spread out over the thousands and thousands of savers, and so no one saver gets completely hit. So that's one function. The other function is the bank, presumably, especially in a free market, would have better personnel who are trained to evaluate credit risks. So the bank's personnel would be better able to tell prospective borrowers or among prospective borrowers which ones were good credit risks and which ones were likely to not pay back the loan. Whereas the households that are saving, you know, you're just working at your job and you're trying to put away money for your retirement or for your kid's college fund, you can't avail. You know, someone comes up and says, hey, I want to borrow $10,000 to build a new factory. You have no idea whether that's a good loan or not if you're just a regular guy. Whereas the bank has personnel, that's their business, that's their job, is to evaluate loan applications. Okay, it doesn't increase the money stock. Since we're low on time, I'm just going to keep moving here. But loan banking does not increase the money stock. It just, money goes from the saver to the bank and then from the bank to the borrower. So it's the same amount of money just getting rearranged. Okay, deposit banking. What we could think of as checking accounts. Here, money, if it's done the way Rothbard likes, money just works as a warehouse. The bank just works as a money warehouse. So the people put their money in the vault. And then when that same family wants to go buy a car, they take some of the money out. Okay, so here, there's no loans involved. The bank is just safekeeping the money. It's more convenient rather than walking around with $10,000 in cash. It's more convenient to have it physically stored at the bank where there's vaults and armed guards and stuff like that and video cameras. And then you go write a check or you swipe a debit card at the various vendors' places of business. All right. This also doesn't increase the money stock, so long as 100% reserve deposit banking. Okay, so as long as, yeah, so let me just, I'll just end on this point. So as long as the bank is truly just acting as a warehouse for your money in the form of deposit banking, then this is not inflationary. It's just changing the form of your money. So the difference, under loan banking, remember, the family, the people who are saving and giving their money over to the bank, it's no longer their money. They've taken present goods, you know, they have 1,000 ounces of gold, they give it to the bank, and they get an IOU. The bank says, I will give you 1,050 ounces of gold in 12 months. So right now, that family doesn't have money anymore. It's just got this claim, this debt claim from the bank. Under deposit banking, it is still your money. The family puts 1,000 ounces of gold in the bank, and it gets a checkbook that has 1,000 ounces on deposit, and it can go around town. The family can write checks because it's just storing the money. So there, it just changed the form, as it were. Rather than keeping the money in your pocket, you're keeping it at the bank, but it's still your money. It's not that you've made a loan to the bank. It's you're just giving it to the bank to hold as safekeeping. It's like the bank is a big silo that you put corn in or something, and it just stores it for you. Or it's like a storage garage. Like you're a college kid and you have a couch and you're in between apartments while you're gonna, you know, you're going home for the summer, and then you're gonna come back and move into a different apartment in September. Maybe you get a storage facility that keeps your couch and your gravity bong or whatever else you crazy kids do these days, your lava lamps and so forth, and you keep it in a storage garage. You're not lending the company your couch. You're paying the company money to watch your couch and safeguard it and store it for you. And if you got back in September and said, okay, give me my couch, and they said, oh, you know what, we lent it out to somebody else, come back in a week, you'd be outraged. Right? And that's the same way that Murray Rothbard thinks about demand deposits, or what we would consider to be checking accounts. He's saying, if you're walking around thinking your money is on deposit at the bank and you can spend it at a moment's notice, they better not be lending it out to somebody else. I want 100% reserves. That's what the way Murray Rothbard thinks. Okay, we're out of time. Next week we'll get into what happens if we don't have 100% reserve banking. But I just wanted to explain the basics as Murray Rothbard sees things. One last thing, just be careful, and I'll mention this more in later lectures. Not all Austrians agree with Rothbard on this point. But I, like I say, I'll talk with you guys later about this next week, about that controversy. Okay, so I'm going to send an email out once the quiz for week one is available. So if you don't get emails from me and you want to, let somebody know, because you should be getting them from me. Okay, thanks everybody. Hope you enjoy the course.